Minisode 34
of Futures Radio Show, sponsored by CME Group, the world's leading and most diverse futures and options exchange. CME Group's markets help individuals and businesses around the world effectively manage risk. For access to free educational tools and resources for the active individual trader, please visit activetrader.cmegroup.com.
Every day, traders and investors dive in to tackle the ever-changing markets to find opportunity. Futures Radio Show is your number one source for answers to the questions that all market participants want to ask. Veteran futures trader Anthony Crudele sits down with the most influential leaders and top traders in the industry. Now, here's your host, Anthony Crudele.
Hey everyone, before I begin today, I want to thank our sponsors, CME Group, Trading Technologies, RJO Futures, and Top Step Trader. Now today I spoke with two guests, Tony Greer, owner of TG Macro, and Kevin Muir, author of The Macro Tourist, and together they are the founders of Wearsbeaks.com. We began today's conversation by talking about their new side hustle, Wearsbeaks.com. And then we dove right into Kevin's latest post discussing the Fed model, bonds, and how we use COT data. Then we chatted about crude oil, cannabis, and cryptos. As usual, thank you all for listening, and please enjoy this episode. Tony, Kevin, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you.
Thanks, Anthony.
It's great to have TG Macro and the Macro Tourist on the same show. So it's pretty safe to say that we're going to talk some macro today. But before we get into talking about some macro topics on the markets, I want to talk about your guys' new side hustle, Where is Beaks? I'll start off with you, Tony. You have a pretty cool story to share with us. Let's start there.
Yeah, well, you know, Where is Beaks is Kevin and I's attempt to bring back, the flavor of the days of open outcry. And one of the stories that I'm working on that's going to go up on the site is, it's about an open outcry trader in natural gas. And it's about one rookie and one, wily veteran of the open outcry process. And, it's about a new local in the ring that used to work upstairs for a big bank. And he went downstairs, to trade his own money because he really thought that he could make it on his own. And he'd been punting around two lots and five lots. And he came in hungover one Friday morning. And as always in the markets, before you get started, you talk about what your levels are. And the next thing he knows, the bell rings. Natural gas is trading up against his resistance level at 250. A guy comes in the ring, 49 bid 100. And my buddy Lurdy, the rookie, says, sold 100, right? So he's got a 100 contract position on for the first time in his life, up from trading a 5 or a 10 lot. And that's a pretty big business in natural gas. So now it's a couple minutes later and, the market settles in and it's kind of 8.5 bid at 9 bid at a half. So he's got this huge position on. He wants to stop out above 50 cents. And he's starting to sweat a little bit. He's still hung over from the night before. And he's like, boy, this is going to be some day. And all of a sudden, the biggest paper broker in the ring, a guy named Dookie from EDF Man, comes into the ring. And Lurdy is like, oh, boy, this is going to be some ride. I'm either about to stop out here or make a ton of money. And Dookie comes in and he starts wailing on natural gas and he sells 8.5s and he hits the 8 bids and he's like, I'm at 8 at 8. JP Morgan's bid 7. Now Lurdy's trying to cover a short from Dookie, who is selling contracts to everybody in the ring. And Lurdy's just on the bidding for his 100 back. And Dookie's selling them to everybody else in the ring. He's hitting all the paper brokers. He's hitting bids down to 6. Lurdy is at this point jumping up and down in front of him. I'm 6 bid 100 to cover. I'm 6 bid 100. Dookie sells his last couple hundred lots down at 5.5. All of a sudden, as he finishes up the order, he says, I sold 52 lots to you. He sold 29 to another local, and he sold 100 to Lurdy to clean up his position at 5. And Lurdy finally says, oh, my God, thank you so much, and he cleans him up at the low print of all the contracts he traded. And Lurdy finally, he looks at me, he's like, I can't believe you didn't see me the whole time. I was trying to cover the whole way down. And, Dookie is like, come on, kid, I saw you. So this is just a good story about how the locals would, really make it fair to the people that were out there taking risk, and in addition to filling the paper orders on the way down, they were also, had an eye out for the people that were risking their own money. And it's a kind of good feel-good story about open outcry I like to bring back every now and then.
Yeah, man. I mean, it reminds me a lot of what it was like, and I was in the S&P pit, and I remember a lot of times, I mean, especially for me as a brand new trader standing in the pit, I bid or offer on something, and the brokers or the bigger traders would just look at me and shake their head and be like, I'm not going to hit you. I'm going to save you from yourself, buddy. You know, and you're like, no, I want them. I want them. And then they're like, no, you don't. You don't want these.
Yeah, exactly.
So what brought this together? How did you two come together to say, hey, you know what, let's do this? And why the name Where Is Beaks? I mean, we know who Beaks is, but why did you come up with that name?
Tell him, Kev.
Well, I still kind of laugh, and Tony and I, we came to know each other because we write similar stuff, and one of our kind of mutual friends, Wolf, put us in touch with each other, and we just found ourselves chatting and telling stories, and I still have a big smile across my face when I've heard this story from Tony for the third time now, and it's still kind of made me kind of laugh and smile, and it's just kind of an attempt to recreate those moments that are lacking in these days. You know, too many people are sticking in VWAP orders, and it's become so boring, and it's an attempt to relive our youth maybe a little bit.
No, very cool. I love it. I love that you two got together and are doing this. All I can say is that after reading the two of you for a good period of time, I'm super excited to see what you guys are going to continue to do with this website. So tell everybody the website.
Yeah, it's Where Is Beaks, and Tony busy spelling Beaks wrong, but if you actually go look at the Trading Places
script, right?
It's actually Beaks. It's EE, that's correct. And the other thing is, if anyone else wants to write some stories, please submit them. We already received a couple other stories from other traders that are sharing their kind of experiences, and we're more than happy to have anybody that has stories that isn't a VWAP or an algorithm writing their trading. We're happy to post them and share them with everybody else.
Yeah, this is also going to morph into a podcast. You know, it may not be a super regular one to start off, but Kevin and I have got some really, really good guests in mind, people with a lot of experience from the days of Open Outcry, and we think that they would be really, really fun guests to have on. So we are working on that behind the scenes as well as we sort of launch the written story versions of this. There's going to be a really cool couple of podcasts to follow.
Oh man, I'm looking forward to it. I can't wait to tune into that. Now let's talk a little bit. I want to start with you, Kev. Your latest post was very interesting to me, and I always love how you put these things out there that I didn't know about, and then gets me thinking. And the latest one was called the Fed model, and it was discussing interest rates versus the levels versus some levels in the S&P. And this is right in my backyard because that's what I basically trade all the time. Is I'm trading a lot of the short end of the curve, and I trade the S&P. Talk to us a little bit about this post and why you decided to write it.
Well, I'd always kind of wondered what was the Fed model. You'd heard it talked about, and it was basically a way of valuing stocks versus interest rates. And but where did it come from? Why was it called the Fed model? And so I kind of did a little bit of research and dug it up. And it started in 1997 in a Humphrey Hawkins testimony by Alan Greenspan, where he commented on the earnings yield of the S&P 500, meaning the earnings per share divided by the price of the actual index to get a yield, versus the interest rate. And he mentioned it in his testimony. And after that, Ed Yardini, who at the time was with Deutsche Morgan Grenfeld, actually dubbed it the Fed model based upon the fact that it was mentioned here. It actually was never officially endorsed by the Federal Reserve, and I think that in subsequent years they mentioned it just briefly, but it wasn't something that was actually charted and basically followed by the Fed. But it still was something that Wall Street embraced and started to watch. And the reason is if you think about it, stocks should be correlated to the long-term interest rate of the discount rate, and they should go together. And if we all know, if interest rates go down, then stocks should go up, you know, in terms, and especially when you look at it on a yield basis in terms of earnings versus the actual underlying index level. But one of the things that Greenspan noted in 1997 was the fact that stocks had actually risen more than the earning or than the interest rates had fallen. And so what I did was I actually went and created the Fed model and kind of went and looked at it from the period of 1982 to 2018. And what I noticed was that there was a period from the first 20 years where the earnings yield, meaning that the level upon which stocks traded versus their earnings, was actually lower than the 10-year interest rate. Then in 2002, it flipped, and actually stocks traded higher relative to the actual interest rate. And I thought about why that might be and kind of went through it in my mind, and I realized that the model was kind of flawed. It might work fine when interest rates are 5, 4, or maybe even 3.5, but as interest rates go closer and closer to zero, if you kind of stop and think about it, the price that you're willing to pay for the actual stock indexes would approach infinity as that interest rate approaches zero. And then if you went into a state like a situation whereas in Europe where you actually have negative rates, it breaks down completely and it just can't be done. So you realize that the Fed model, maybe it worked when the rates were 4 or 5, but as rates went lower, it broke down. Now, there's lots of other reasons that people kind of postulate why it doesn't work. Some people argue that you should use corporate rates. Other people argue that interest rates are nominal kind of instrument that don't protect against inflation, whereas stocks are a real asset. And I don't really have any answers. I just thought it was really interesting to look at these two periods and to realize that there was definitely a distinct period where stocks traded rich to interest rates, and now almost the opposite, where interest rates are more expensive, meaning like bonds are a higher price relative to stocks. It's like bonds have gone down in yield, up in price, and stocks almost don't believe that that's the correct level. That's almost my interpretation.
Hmm. Yeah, Tom, what did you think? What did you think about that post?
It's good. It's always, I can always count on Kevin to make, these generational observations, because I find that he's always looking, I feel like I'm looking from 30,000 feet up and he's looking from 300,000 feet up. So I always appreciate his views. And I just feel like, the central banking as it relates to the stock market lately has been, the method for central banks to manage their currency against bouts with deflation and slower economies, and sort of, just managing it against the rest of the world. You know what I mean? We had a period where the dollar was really strong and the stock market was rallying, and Trump took office, and then they started selling the dollar and the stock market rally stayed intact, and then Europe started rallying for a while. So I always feel like it's just this mechanism for central banks to, try to inflate or deflate their currency against what's going on in their own domestic economy with regards to the economic strength and deflation. But, I do certainly see how, as rates stay lower for longer, that, investors have no choice but to get pushed down onto the yield curve. And where else would you be going to get, a good yield except for the S&P dividend yield? That seems like one of the best games in town to me. Those are my only thoughts, Tom.
Yeah, Kev, I want to go back to you a little bit about the execution side of stuff, because you and I, and all the times that we've spoken, there's always a trade possibility or something that I get from looking at your post, and I know that maybe you'll be looking to trade as well. Is there anything from this recent post that you see trade opportunity?
Well, I look at it and wonder if the stock market is not directly influenced by the central bank as much as the bonds are. So I almost wonder if that's a freer market and that's an actual, the correct price, more so than the bonds. So yeah. I look at this, and whereas people will say, oh, bonds have backed up a long way, I kind of think to myself, well, versus the S&P, you could see, if this relationship were to go back in place, it would basically mean that the 10-year would be trading 4.5%.
Yeah.
So I look at it as like, maybe it's not telling us anything about the stock market, but maybe it's telling us that bonds can still back up a whole long way. Now, don't get me wrong. When I put on my trader hat, I'm kind of worried about the bond market in terms of everybody is short. But there's a little part of me that says, you know, maybe everybody is short, but there's good reasons for it because maybe we're headed still in, you know, another 100 basis points higher.
It sounds exactly like the crude oil market where everybody is long. It feels like all the longs are right, and it feels like there's even more room on the upside, but I didn't want to switch topics too fast on you.
Yeah, we're definitely going to get to crude oil here in just a moment, Tone, but I want to stay on the treasury markets and talk a little bit about the COT data because I've actually been tweeting a lot about this lately, talking about how I see a lot of people on Twitter and even people, you know, writing posts talking about the overcrowded positions, short positions in treasuries and bonds. And although I do look at COT data, I've learned that markets that are really crowded short or really crowded long could stay that way and still be right. I mean, have we learned nothing? Look at the S&P. For years, I heard people say, there's too many people long it, it can't keep going up, and it does. And when I look at the bond market, that chart looks very bearish to me. I've been very open about it. I've been aggressively looking to sell rallies in the 10-year this year and last year. Not always working out, but right now, as of late, it has been. And I just see more and more people saying that everybody's crowded in short in treasuries. But when I look at the chart, I'm like, well, maybe they're crowded for a reason. Maybe this thing can't keep going. I mean, I don't doubt that it's impossible. Kev, you just mentioned 4.5%. I think that's actually possible in the 10-year. I don't know if it's possible this year, but as far as I'm concerned, nothing's impossible. But I just want to make that point that looking at the COT data is not necessarily swaying me from wanting to be short the treasury market.
Price is the ultimate arbiter. Like that's nothing else matters. We can sit around arguing about whether everyone's long or short, but where the price goes is all that really matters.
Yeah, and I would add that I'd never want to get lumped into that category of traders that's just constantly drawing a bullseye on every large spec position out there. Because like you said, I mean, they get big for a reason and they stay large. And a lot of times the security that they're trading on is going the same way. And there's, you know, there's a lot of reasons behind it. So
now, one thing I will say, Anthony, one thing I will add, though, is that the positioning ends up causing any sorts of reactions when the trend does change to be more violent. So if, for example, we did get some weak economic news in the States, the short covering would be much more vicious based upon the positioning of the speculators right now.
That is an excellent point, Kevin. I'm glad you brought that up. And everyone knows I love to talk about execution. And this is the reason why I look at the COT data. This is the reason why I read macro. So in a situation where we did get a bounce in treasuries, knowing that there is a lot of shorts out there, maybe some weak hands take the rally a little bit longer than you think. So don't be in a hurry to sell your first area of resistance. Maybe you wait to sell your second or third because the rally could be a little more vicious. All right, great stuff. I want to move on and talk a little bit about crude oil here. Tone, I have to give you props. Last time you were on the show, I asked you what your favorite trade was, and you told me long crude oil. You talked to us about how you got into the trade. You talked to us through the execution and how you were looking to trail and try and stay long it. So it's been quite some time since we did speak about you getting into that trade. After reading your letter, you're still bullish crude oil. I believe you're still in the trade. So talk to us about how you're executing your trade and your thoughts on crude oil going forward.
Sure. I tell you, it's I've been keeping my eye on Khalid Al-Fali, who is the Saudi oil minister. And he is, you know, an outspoken leader of OPEC, and he has been saying the entire time that their goal is to cut the U.S. Excess supply down. The way he was going to do that is with OPEC production cuts. If you believed in his narrative and you watched the physical side of the oil market tighten, meaning watch the one-year spread, calendar spreads tighten, watch the curve go more backwardated. You were able to stay in the oil trade with no problem. We got oil up into the 50s, and the spec position got pretty large. And the DMARC traders came out and said, okay, we've got sequential 9s and 13s and crude oil is going to turn over again. But they really weren't watching the underlying dynamics, which were massive growth in U.S. crude exports. And that was a real big lever for me to see exports growing, to seeing crude values at various different locations around the country, not just WTI, rallying in price due to foreign demand, from China, from India, et cetera. And that was just able to get, I was able to stay with the narrative, so that was really just staying in this uptrend in the crude oil market and in USO that I think we talked about trading. I was probably somewhere around, 11 or 12 bucks back then, or somewhere between 10 and 12. And now we're up at 14 and a half. And that if you look at the USO chart, which you and I probably have a lot of technical analysis background together, the chart, the trend is pretty as a picture. And when you look at the USO chart and you need some confidence to stay long at the highs, what I continue to do is look at the DC crude oil chart and see that that spread hasn't backed off at all. So you're seeing the calendar spread staying, not only stay remain tight, but remained in an uptrend even tighter. And that's when I started drilling down into a couple of more equities that I thought would really get a good bang for their buck if we had an ascending crude oil and gasoline price. So if you stayed with, the Khalid Al-Falih narrative, if you followed Mohammed bin Salman and his trip to 60 Minutes and his tour around the United States, he's trying to sort of pave the way socially for the Saudi Aramco IPO. And even though the Aramco IPO has been delayed until next year, 2019, the crude oil price has hung in there because they've maintained this narrative. Whenever it looks like it's going to curl over, you see a headline out of Saudi Arabia that says, yeah, we're thinking $80 or $100 crude oil is more like the right price. And you look at the Cushing supplies, and Cushing is absolutely getting drained. And you look at the fact that Saudi Arabia hasn't exported more than 1 million barrels of oil to the U.S. in any single week this year. And I just started adding those up on my yellow legal pad on the bullish side, and it's kept me in the crude oil trade. So the only other thing that I would add is that it got me to drill down into the refiners. And I jumped on Marathon Petroleum fairly early, and I was able to get into the stock because it started performing really well. It took out the 2015 highs at $60, and then all of a sudden there was this tidal wave of positive headlines for the refiners. First there was that headline out of the International Maritime Organization where they're lowering sulfur emissions in all shippers and tankers to 0.5% from 3.5%. Right now, all that means is that they've got to have cleaner fuel emissions, from the gasoline that they burn. Now, if you're a refiner that easily burns that sweeter gasoline with less sulfur emission in it, then you're in great shape. And that's where, Marathon Petroleum and Phillips 66 really started getting juiced. And then we just had at the end of April last month, Marathon Petroleum bought Andeavor, which used to be Tesoro Refinery. So now we've got consolidation in that industry, and I'm still really excited about it, but I don't want to keep going talking. I'd love to hear what you have to say in return, but that's what I've been following in the crude oil market.
Hey everyone, I hope you're enjoying the show so far, but I want to pause and thank one of our sponsors, Trading Technologies. I started using TT in the year 2000, and I love it. It is by far the best trading platform I have ever used, and I've tried a lot of them. With TT, you can trade the global markets from virtually anywhere in the world. They are the world's fastest commercially available futures trading platform. I highly suggest you go try out TT, especially because you can try it for free. Just go to tryttnow.com and set up your account. So you've been bullish, you remain bullish. And I think the one question I have is, how does this trade go wrong? Where does this trade all of a sudden get you out from buying dips, staying long, and potentially look at shorts?
Man, I'm not even close. I'm not there. I still see that we are, we've got synchronized global growth. The story is still alive, okay? It gets stronger and it falters and it gets stronger and it falters. But in general, I think that we are seeing global economic growth. In general, I think that as long as the Saudis have got this Aramco IPO on the calendar, that they are going to be in control and they are going to maintain the narrative and the pace of crude oil going higher. Because if they keep, these production cuts, if they keep extending these production cuts, even through U.S. backing out of the Iran deal, I don't think that's going to be a major issue. I guess if this whole narrative comes apart, If we start seeing drastic pullback in the U.S. And Chinese economies where, you know, where like you guys just spoke about, where we see the bond markets rally and we have this sort of period of a perceived economic weakness, I guess maybe the longs will pull the trigger and get out of crude oil. But, you know, I'm really focusing on the Saudi Aramco IPO, and I'm really focusing on everything that comes out of the headlines there, because they've been carrying the narrative, and everything they seem to do turns out bullish crude oil. And then you get the inventory reports every week, and you have 5 million barrel draws, and the shorts are all forced to cover again. So I'm just trying to play this from the long side. Technically speaking, I've got a target of about $85 in crude oil, and I'm not going to get bearish till we get there.
Kev, what are you seeing in the crude oil markets?
Well, I think Tony's done a great job at just staying long, which has been really tough, because if you actually go and talk to different hedgies, it seems like everybody is short. Whereas Tony's trying to come up with reasons to be long, it seems like everybody else is coming up with reasons why this thing has to go down. And, you know, they often talk about how the stock market climbs a wall of worry, but I don't think there's been any better example of an asset climbing the wall of worry than crude oil over the last year. And the other thing is the COT data. A lot of these hedgies will go and they'll point to the COT data and say, look at all these speculative longs. This is going to end in disaster. And they all repeat about how, you know, they envision 2014 and 15 to happen again. And, people talk about $20 oil and all that sort of just kind of disaster scenarios. And meanwhile, the price just keeps chugging higher. And I don't believe that COT data. When I look at it, it looks to me like something's wrong. I think at one point I speculated that it almost feels like China's in there buying futures and labeling themselves speculative, because the COT data is showing so much long positioning in crude oil. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't jive with what you're seeing, because on the whole, it just feels to me like all the specs are short. Everyone's looking for a reason to sell it, not a reason to buy it. So I hats off to Tony. I think it's been a great trade. I think the other thing is that he's right, that it's a play on global growth. And, even if we have a hiccup in terms of, the growth kind of pauses for a little bit, you know, we're still, China's growing at an immense rate. And it might be less in terms of as a percentage compared to what they used to do. But if you look in absolute dollars, it's actually quite huge. And the other thing that you have to remember is that if you go look at energy use per income, and you go look at kind of other societies that have kind of industrialized, and you go to Japan in the, I guess it would be the 50s, and then you go look at Korea in the 60s and the 70s, what you'll find is as they got more and more wealthy, the energy use kind of goes up a little bit. And then it kind of hits this point where they become wealthy enough that they buy a car and all of a sudden their energy use goes through the roof. They have electricity, they have all sorts of things. And it looks like a hockey stick. And you look at Japan, it did that. You go look at Korea, it did that. And I think China, we're just at the point of the hockey stick where it's about to take off. And I think that it would be a mistake to underestimate the amount of energy use that's going to come out of China.
Yeah.
Great call.
A lot to think about there. Thanks for the insight, Kevin. I want to go back to Tony on the second C that we're going to talk about today, and this is cannabis. And this is a story that I've been seeing for a while, and it's not something I've really been engaged in until as of late. And I'm going to give you a quick story as to the reasons why I'm now starting to believe that this cannabis story could be something bigger, because I have old dogs. Anyone that follows me on Twitter knows I put pictures of my dogs. I love my dogs, right? I have one left. One of them passed away. But my wife, after my dog's last ACL surgery, came home and she was doing some research on the internet. And she said to me, maybe we should look at CBDs. A friend online said to me, Anthony, you should look at CBDs. And then I go to my vet and we mentioned it. And she's like, oh, we actually have CBDs here. And we're talking about it. I'm sitting there going, all of a sudden, I have multiple people telling me to take a look at these
is something that comes from cannabis for my dog. And obviously I want the best for him. And I'm thinking to myself, this is where it all starts. It starts with, you know, the pets, and we all know how big of a business that is. I know how much money I spend on my dogs, and what I would do anything for them. And to me, I could see how this eventually soon follows with humans. And maybe it's already happening, and maybe I just don't know about it. Tone, what do you like about this cannabis story, and how are you playing it?
Well, just like you said, you know, it becomes something that all of a sudden you have different angles of your world telling you about, you know, whether it's cannabis stocks or cannabinoids or whatever part of the wellness plan now, you know, cannabis is going along with. You know, I see how that shakes you all of a sudden when, you know, all of a sudden now it's related to your dogs and now it's in your everyday household life. And now you've got a couple of angles that you can make investments in it. The same kind of headline smacked me upside the head when Constellation Brands bought a 9.9% stake in Canopy Growth. I was sort of waiting for a headline that was going to shake me into the space, and that was it, right? On that day, I bought MedRelief and I bought Canopy Growth just because I thought that that started the beginning of consolidation where now beverage makers were going to figure out how to put cannabis into their drinks. And all of a sudden, every beverage maker was going to have to be long a grower. So I didn't really worry about price. And I just waded into that as a space that I thought I needed to be moving money toward and needing some kind of a trigger to get my first exposure. So I got the first exposure there. I continue to hear stories like you, you know, about how cannabis is becoming part of the wellness picture, you know, and no longer looked at as pothead drugs. And obviously you see, you know, the vaporizer pens are all over the place and it's becoming a lot more mainstream and getting legalized all over the place. So I, you know, I'm still in those names. I'm still in Canopy Growth. Just today we got the headline that MedRelief was purchased for $3.2 billion in all stock by Aurora Cannabis, which is interesting. So that's the sort of consolidation that I was looking for. And I can't really claim to know the answers, but I am starting to develop a list of stocks to follow and I can tell which ones are going to break out. You know, that's how I'm playing it.
Kev, I haven't seen you write about cannabis. So I'm just wondering, do you have any thoughts on cannabis?
Well, first of all, I'm going to make Tony an honorary Canadian. He's going long crude oil and long cannabis. And for those who don't know, Canada is actually the cannabis capital of the world. We're huge growers. Some might argue we're huge consumers of the product as well. But we actually are one of the leading countries in terms of actually producing and selling this. And some of that has to do with the fact that we've just allowed it and we've put in place the regulations to allow companies to sell it. And so we're ahead of the thing, ahead of the curve in terms of all this. I don't have anything to add. Tony's much better at riding these kind of popular trading waves than I am. But I will say that the amount of enthusiasm in the Canadian financial markets for these products is just huge. And the stories that I've heard, it's kind of like the dot-com bubble, but for weed. And it's kind of funny to see Main Street like big Canadian banks fighting all over themselves to be the first ones to underwrite a pot deal. Because for the longest time, the big banks wouldn't touch this stuff, and it was all kind of these smaller brokers. And just kind of in the last week or so, one of the big banks, I believe it was Bank of Montreal, went and actually did a deal with the pot grower. So it's interesting times for sure.
Let's talk about cryptos. Last topic for today. Now, everyone knows that follows me on Twitter or heard the show, I am trading cryptos now. It's like one of those things, hey, everybody, I'm trading cryptos. You go out there as a futures trader. It's like, you know, is he actually saying this? Is he actually doing this? And you know what? And I'm happy to say that I'm doing it because it took me about a year of watching it. Yeah, I bought a little Bitcoin here and there. And all of a sudden now I'm looking at it and going, I see opportunity. These things are charting well. I finally felt in my mind that it was okay to start trading them. Now, I'm curious what you guys think about cryptos. I'm going to stay with you, Kev, because you have a bit of a history with cryptos, and I've seen you write a little bit about them as well. So, Kev, what do you think about cryptos? And talk to us about your experience with them thus far.
Well, I've got kind of like the biggest mistake that's ever been. I went and there was a fellow that worked with me, and he was a computer scientist, and he told me about Bitcoin at about $5. So he kind of explained it all to me, and I'm like, okay, so you want me to pay $5 for these bits in the sky? And he says, yeah. And I said, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Just go back to your desk. And then he kind of comes a month later and he says, Kev, you know that idea that you told me was the stupidest thing I'd ever heard? Well, guess what? I said, what? He says, it's $50 now. And I might not be smart, but I realized that if it went to $50, there's nothing stopping it from going to $500 or $5,000. So we actually started mining them. And this was way back when. And we were buying these Chinese computers that specialized in doing the mining for for the actual Bitcoin. And we had actually had to move them out of our office because it had gotten too hot and it was just like a sweat shack in there. And not only that, we went and started to do the arbitrage between different exchanges. And that game all ended up being a kind of a credit issue because you wanted to make sure that you didn't get the Mt. Gox, and some exchanges traded at straight arbs. And so it was a very interesting time. I actually, even though I was a little bit of a skeptic, I kind of would trade it and do all sorts of different things to make money. And we did quite well. And it went to $1,000 and then it kind of collapsed to $200. And I, like a fool, said, okay, there it was. That was that's the bubble. It's all over. And so we, at that point, the machines were no longer profitable to operate. So we turned them off and kind of just sold them for parts or whatever. And I thought that would be it, that I would never hear from Bitcoin again. And just goes to show you, I can be wrong twice.
So I hate to tell you this, but you're starting to sound like both Nouriel Roubini and Warren Buffett, Kev.
Yeah. So the other thing is, Anthony, Tony and I have this bet, and I think and I have to give Tony all the credit in the world, because I think that it was Bitcoin was at $5,000, or maybe it was higher. No, it was $8,000. It was $8,000. And I said, and he told me, I'm a little bit of a gold nerd at times. So he said, I think that gold has a better chance of going down than Bitcoin. And so we have this bet about which would hit first. And we kind of volatility adjusted it because it wasn't quite fair, because Bitcoin's zipping around kind of, you know, 50% vol or whatever. And gold trades, you know, relatively lower. So we made this bet that Bitcoin would either, what was it, Tony? It was Bitcoin was going to touch 5,200 or something before gold would touch, I can't remember what the number was, 900. And to Tony's credit, Bitcoin took off and went to 15,000 or 18,000, whatever the number was. And then on the way back down, it's like the Bitcoin gods are like watching our bet, because I keep thinking, okay, here it is. I'm going to win this bet finally. And each time I think I've gotten within $100, and it's somehow Tony's magically, you know, a true technician that he always is, he's figured out the level that it's missed it twice by like $100.
Yeah. It's been amazing, man. I mean, you know, I'm just to keep it flowing, Anthony, you know, I'm amazed at this. I kind of move toward this as another new revolution, you know, along with, you know, the weed stocks and along with electric cars. You know, the cryptocurrency is just something that I see, you know, interest gaining in, and people asking me more about. And the way I'm perceiving it from seeing both the attention that I'm getting here at TG Macro with people ripping my arms off, asking me things about cryptocurrency, I look at that and I see the number of talented people that I know in the markets that are pivoting toward cryptocurrency, either leaving their jobs to go and do a crypto venture, starting a crypto hedge fund. And then I see Goldman Sachs is starting a crypto trading desk, right? And I think that this all speaks to the massive demand, and I feel like it could be a self-fulfilling prophecy of its own. You know, I still love having this option of a non, you know, central bank managed currency out there. And just as somebody that has a little bit of libertarian in them, I like that option out there. So that's why it's one of those things that I start skating toward and putting a little bit of money into, you know, and then therefore when you have a position on, you pay closer attention and we learn as we go. But I think it's going to be with us. I don't want to be any kind of a, you know, sound like any kind of a cryptomaniac. I don't have any Bitcoin tattoos. I never mind it. But I'm long Bitcoin, I'm long Ethereum, I'm bullish the applications, and I think it was really cool that they just tokenized part of the cap structure of a tech stock at the Morgan Creek Hedge Fund, because I think that is where, you know, if you want to think futuristically, you know, I could imagine, you know, all securities traded on the blockchain, managed on the blockchain, cleared on the blockchain. And I think that that is a really, really efficient way of doing it versus the way we've been doing it for, you know, hundreds of years now. So, you know, my ears are just open to new ideas, and I love it to see new talent skating into the arena.
Guys, this was awesome. Thank you so much for coming on Futures Radio Show. Before I let you guys go, we'll start off with you, Kev. Where can people find you on Twitter, and give us a website to check out?
Okay, it's at Kevin Muir, M-U-I-R, and the website is themacrotourist.com. Thanks, Anthony. It's been a lot of fun.
You got it. Tone, where can people find you on Twitter and talk to us about where they can go to check out a website?
Thanks, Tone. I appreciate the exposure. You can find me at TG Macro on Twitter and www.tgmacro.com. I put some of those trade ideas that I was just talking about up in video form on there. And there's some new stuff going on. So check it out when you can.
Yeah, everybody. I highly recommend you go and follow both of these guys on Twitter and check out their websites. I follow both of them very closely. Not only are they two great guys to follow for macro, they're just two great guys in general. And also, let's not forget, guys, where's beaks.com? Everyone should go and check that out as well.
Thanks, Anthony.
That was awesome. Thanks, Ed.
Thank you for listening to Futures Radio Show. If you have any questions or comments for myself or my guests, please visit futuresradioshow.com and sign up to be a premium member for free. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes.